to the campaign of 1954 when I ran against Franklin D. Roosevelt Jr. For Attorney General of the state of New York. That campaign was preceded by a situation which put me in line for the nomination for Attorney General of the state. And that situation developed prior to the mayoralty election in New York of 1953, along about May of that year. I had by then was then by then in my fourth term in the House of Representatives and quite well established as a congressman, having won and kept, and from the campaign of 1952, which I won on an almost 2-to-1 basis against my Democratic opponent, was very likely to keep a seat which for 25 years had simply been granted without any real contest to Tammany Hall in New York. Tom Dewey called me to the Roosevelt Hotel one day where he lived when he was in New York City and said that he thought I ought to run for the mayoralty. This was sometime before lunch. And I told him I was entirely willing. It seemed to be the right moment in my career to come out of the House of Representatives, because it's my view that the House of Representatives is a marvelous training ground for politicians and public men, but there comes a time, and it's just about between the 6th and the 10th year, in other words, the end of the 3rd and the end of the 5th term, where if you don't get out and do something else and break out, as it were, into the open field of a different or higher office, you're going to be stuck in the House as the whole of your career. So I welcomed the opportunity and told the governor exactly that. He said that sounded fine to him and that we now had to work out all the details. We thereupon had a meeting which lasted for at least 8 hours, going through lunch and dinner, going into the every finite detail, both of the administration of the city of New York, its financial condition, its prospects, the degree to which it could grow, its attraction to business, and the factors which repelled business in terms of the city. We dealt especially on the relations between the city and the state, because traditionally the mayor of New York had been the whipping boy for the governor, or the governor had been the whipping boy for the mayor. And this started with Fiorello LaGuardia, who it may be remembered called Governor Lehman, notwithstanding the dignity and great respect in which he was held, a gonef, G-O-N-E-V, which means in Yiddish a crook. Notwithstanding that degree of hostility between the mayor and the governor, somehow or another, the mayor and the governor had to get along, because New York City was 45% of New York State, and of course the major revenue producer in the state, both for the state and the federal government. I told Governor Dewey that I would be an independent mayor, but that as I had always in life done my utmost not to make the other side, and in this case the governor would be the other side, any proposition which I wouldn't accept myself, so that in the bargaining which annually took place between the city and the state as to what aid, either financial, mostly financial, or legislative, the city would get from the state, the asking price by the mayor was always very much higher than he ever expected to get, and the offering price by the governor was always very much lower than he ever expected to give. Tom Dewey rather liked my approach and knew I meant it. On this and other matters, we discussed patronage questions, in which case I said I would listen and evaluate any suggestion the governor had, but reserve the right to make my own decision, but that I would always give him my reason. And again, he liked that. In any case, we got along famously, much better than he and I had ever gotten along before, because we'd had quite a battle while he was governor about rent control. I was ardently for rent control after World War II, and he felt that discouraged landlords from keeping their property in shape, very much the same argument we heard 20 years later and still do hear for such rent control as remains in effect in New York. It was very important to assure a return on capital, and that this required a cessation of rent control, or at least its radical modification. In any case, he was a strong-willed man, so was I. We hadn't gotten along too well, pretty well, but not too well until that time. We reconciled these views, or at least I thought we had reconciled them. And I went away that night, came home and told my wife, Marion, that I had accepted a suggestion or an offer from the governor to run for mayor of New York. And he said he was going to consult his two principal leaders, one Tom Curran of Manhattan, and the other McKenna of Queens, say this was Wednesday that he saw me, he talked to them Thursday, and let me know finally on Friday. Friday morning, Governor Dewey called me and said that the two leaders were adamantly opposed to me. These two gentlemen were old-fashioned, Republican, conservative, Irish politicians, and many of the things that I had done and stood for, they didn't like. They didn't like the fact that I was also the Liberal Party nominee for Congress, as well as the Republican. They didn't like the fact that I voted to sustain Truman's veto on the Taft-Hartley Law in 1948. They didn't like the fact that I was adamantly opposed to all forms of McCarthyism and fought against and voted against the Munt-Nixon Bill, which sought to categorize public employees in terms of their belonging or not belonging to something called the, quote, international communist conspiracy, end of quote. And I was deeply opposed to that on policy and on constitutional grounds. In any case, they blackballed me. Now, Tom Dewey could very easily have overridden them, as he had on many other occasions before. But he must have had second thoughts about me, which they awakened and confirmed. And so he told me he was sorry, but it was no go. I was deeply disappointed, but I took it in good part. The nominee that year was Republican Harold Riegelman, a wonderful man with whom I had served in the war in the chemical warfare service, and he went on to the inevitable defeat, was clearly forecast in a normal New York mayoralty race without some sensational development. And I think I would have been that sensational development, which occurs to change the normal course of events. It is a fact too that this just about marked the last time that I really counted myself in the mayoralty race. I entertained the idea on a number of other occasions. It was generally fell a year before I was due to run for re-election. So I entertained the idea again in 61 when I got John Lindsay to run. And that's a sensational story all by itself, including a very amusing incident of an allegedly private meeting at the Hotel Roosevelt, which through a dumbwaiter that was used to send food up and down, the press overheard and reported verbatim, including a real scrap between myself and Governor Dewey and other Republican leaders. I entertained the idea again in 70 in 73 quite seriously. I entertained it even more seriously in 69 when it was clear that John Lindsay wouldn't run again. But somehow or other, that 53 date marked the high water point of my interest in the mayoralty. I felt that I, at all times, I've not had a good conscience about the city, and as far as I'm concerned. I felt that I could do a great deal for the city, and the great deal that had not been done. But as I built into the Senate in a real way in later years, I felt that I also could do a great deal for the nation and a great deal for peace. And my fundamental war experience, which gave me my original commitment to politics, inevitably, almost subconsciously prevailed. And while I agonized, and the newspapers had lots of fun with observing me agonize from time to time about the mayoralty, it was almost inevitable that I would decide the other way in view of the deep conscious and subconscious commitment that I had to peace and to the developments, or the U.S. part in the developments in the world, which was such an essential part of my life and my commitment. We come now actually to the campaign of 1954, to which this was something of a preliminary. In 1954, it's right to start with a situation in the Democratic Party rather than in the Republican Party. Tom Dewey was mayor, and Tom Dewey was governor. And his term was expiring, and he had to choose a totally new ticket, and he was the undisputed titular and non-titular boss of the Republican Party in the state of New York at that time. And he had decided upon Irving Ives for governor. Irving Ives was my colleague in the Senate, a man who had had a marvelous career in the state legislature of New York, was one of the most highly respected senators in the United States Senate, and had a legendary reputation as an advocate of civil rights, having been the author of the Ives-Quinn Bill, the first law against discrimination and employment opportunity, which was passed in New York as early as 1945. This was a bad idea for Irving Ives, but he was certainly the most prominent Democrat, Republican in the state other than Tom Dewey. And Tom Dewey simply picked him and decided he would make him run, which apparently he was able to do. A matter of fact, this was a disaster for Irving Ives right through, including the rest of his life. It cost him his Senate seat. He ultimately retired from politics altogether and didn't live very long thereafter, having really lost his taste for politics in that 1954 gubernatorial campaign and having the heart taken out of him by the developments which I will describe. In any case, that was Tom Dewey's idea, but what happened in the Democratic Party and brought me into the picture was rather a change for even Tom Dewey. A big fight developed between Carmine DiSapio, then the leader of Tammany Hall, and Tammany Hall leaders then, even then, only some 25 years ago, were still the most potent single Democratic figure in the state of New York. Carmine DiSapio was in a big row with Franklin D. Roosevelt, Jr., the son of the president, the four-time president, and still carrying in those days the great reputation of the family and so powerful a political standing as even to exceed that of the Kennedys in later days and to make young Frank feel that he could really name the office he wanted and the people would surely elect him to it. So he thought he was negotiating from great strength, and he wanted the gubernatorial nomination, while Carmine DiSapio's choice was Averell Harriman. Harriman had been a very loyal Democrat, been active for a very long time, but hardly ever in state affairs. He was mainly and primarily an international figure and one with a relation to the presidency, having been aide director immediately after World War II and occupied ambassadorial posts in the Soviet Union and many other very distinguished roles. In any case, whether it was because he could well afford to finance a campaign or because DiSapio really detected Franklin D. Roosevelt Jr.'s weakness, DiSapio was for Harriman. At that time, Franklin D. Roosevelt Jr. was a congressman, having been elected on the Liberal Party ticket as a result of a major political contest against the quote organization, that is the Tammany Hall organization, in a district on the Middle West Side of New York. And so I had one advantage over any other candidate. I knew Franklin D. Roosevelt as a congressman and knew his weaknesses, which proved to be his undoing in the campaign of 54. Well, in any case, this fracas became very acute and even went on during the convention of the Democrats, which was in New York and Buffalo at that time, or New York City, I forget which. And this convention was contemporaneous with a Republican convention to name gubernatorial and other statewide candidates in Syracuse, New York, in August of 1954. It then appeared on a given day, the conventions each lasted only a few days, but generally occupied the attention of politicians for a whole week, that Harriman would prevail over Roosevelt and that DiSapio would be successful over Franklin D. Roosevelt Jr. And also that Franklin D. Roosevelt Jr. was going to, quote, try to strengthen the Democratic ticket, unquote. At least that's what Frank thought of himself, by accepting the nomination for Attorney General, thus showing he was a good and loyal party man and having taken his beating would nonetheless stay on the team. And Tom Dewey was then faced with a need for choosing a candidate to run against FDR Jr. So one day, say around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he called me up from my tiny cubicle in the Syracuse Hotel to the impressive surroundings of his suite on the top floor. And I remember very distinctly that he sat up on a bed with his legs stretched out, motioned me to a chair to the left side of him, facing him, looked me straight in the eye and said, quote, "Jack, why should I nominate you for Attorney General?" I thought a full 30 seconds and answered, "Governor, you should nominate me for Attorney General because I think I'm the only Republican who can beat Franklin D. Roosevelt Jr." End of quote. And we then talked about the details of Frank's incumbency in the Congress. And I pointed out to the governor that he was very much an absentee congressman, that he did not treat his duties with the seriousness that I thought he should, and that his absenteeism and general lack of personal involvement, though he did get into some issues like rent control, was such that he even strongly and seriously espoused given positions and then never showed up in the House when those were being debated on the floor or when it was necessary to put in or to fight against an amendment respecting those given positions. And here a note should be taken that the campaign documents should be looked over from the point of view of the specific examples which I then gave in the course of the campaign, which were very real and very, very material ones. The governor then said that he thought that that made a good case and that he would nominate me for Attorney General. He gave the necessary instructions, and I was duly nominated for Attorney General on that ticket. And I don't think that there were 20 delegates in that hall who had the remotest idea that I could win that election. But in view of my reputation as probably the leading liberal of the Republican Party, certainly in New York, it simply one good mark for me, because I was going to help buttress the ticket and get it voting strength, which could elect Irving Ives as governor. Obviously, I had very little time to prepare for the campaign of 54 between August and November. But with the great aid of my campaign manager, whom I recruited promptly, a young lawyer named John Trubin, who was then practicing law in the city and was a leader among the young Republicans of the city and state, who were very much of my view as to the direction in which the Republican Party should go, and the aid of my wife Marion, who turned to in the most tremendous way to line up volunteers. Indeed, in that campaign, I think we had 5,000 volunteers in the state. And the vigor of my own attack on Franklin D. Jr.'s record in the Congress, we put together in fantastically short time a really strong and effective campaign, including for the first time in my own career, a very effective series of television appearances. And I shall describe a characteristic one to indicate the effectiveness of this television drive. I should add, in connection with those who helped me so materially in that key campaign for me, the breakout from the House of Representatives as far as I was concerned, my brother, who turned to with the most fantastic energy and determination and effectiveness to raise a campaign chest for me. We spent in that campaign blank hundreds of thousands of dollars, and he raised it all single-handed, a really unbelievable performance. Now, Franklin D. Roosevelt Jr. Sort of tried to brush me off at the beginning of the campaign as a nice man, a liberal, but of course not in any way able to challenge him. But as my attack began to bite in on his absenteeism and general neglect of his duties in the Congress when he had the opportunity, he became more and more active and realized that he was in some danger. Though I don't think until the end, until his actual defeat, he realized that he was in any real danger from me in respect of this particular race. In any case, my volunteers went to work with the same techniques that we had used in the 21st Congressional District, where I was then a member of Congress. Indeed, so quick was my elevation to the nomination for Attorney General that the posters announcing my candidacy for re-election to the House of Representatives were still up in the 21st Congressional District when new posters began to appear stating that I was running for Attorney General. Another thing that I did was to divorce my campaign completely from that of the candidate for governor, the candidate for lieutenant governor, and the candidate for controller. I decided that if I was to make this, I had to go all out in a single unitary campaign against FDR Jr. strictly on my own, and that's exactly what I did. Now, as to the key issues. Oh, yes, one other thing as to campaign techniques. We had utilized the telephone to some extent in the campaigns for Congress on in the 21st District. But this time, we made a command decision to go in for telephone banks on a huge scale. And we made literally hundreds of thousands of telephone calls with the aid of hundreds of volunteers in telephone banks throughout the state using a set pattern for the approach to the voter who answered the telephone and not deviating from it. So that though there were, after all, in number, a considerable number of turndowns, rejections, or refusals to talk, in percentage, we scored enormously by not having any debates or inconsistencies between the presentation made by individual telephoners. And we were able to use people of considerable inexperience who were simply reading a manual in making the telephone call, a very effective technique, not just the telephone bank, which of course has been much and widely used, but the set pattern of what was said and the willingness to accept losses in that connection because of the great amount of gains. Now the key issue in the campaign turned out to be a big happenstance. There is also a key technique, but I'd like to give each of them. The key issue turned out to be my reaction to an accusation by Irving Ives, incidentally at the strong behest of Governor Dewey, because it was very much his style of campaigning, but not the style that Irving Ives could carry off. A charge made by Irving Ives against Harriman that 25 years before, when he was in the securities business, in some form of stock deal respecting a shipping company, he had been guilty of sharp practice, indeed dishonest, in terms of securities. And Ives, using Dewey's language, which ill befitted Ives, and that, by the way, that's a big lesson in respect of campaign, never be anything than yourself, literally called Averell Harriman a thief. One fine day, when the day this story broke, I was up at Columbia in the McMillan Theater making a speech to the students in my own campaign, had the remotest notion that this thing was breaking as far as Ives was concerned, emerged from the speech sometime in the afternoon, 2 or 3 o'clock, and was immediately overwhelmed by a swarm of reporters who wanted to know what I thought about this charge of Irving Ives against Harriman. And my answer was, and which was immediate, quote, "I do not believe Averell Harriman to be a dishonest man," end of quote. And I then proceeded to disassociate myself from this charge. That proved to be the turning point of the campaign. It did Ives in because it was an allegation which he found it very hard to really support. And it assailed the public credibility. It was just hard for people to believe. And by the way, there's a big lesson in that in terms of campaigning too, and that the public has some brains too, and it's a great mistake to impose upon what reasonable people will believe to be reasonable. Even under the most partisan stress, this is a great mistake to be sedulously avoided. I think Ives paid for it with his election to governor, and indeed I think paid for it with his life. He was so discouraged and frustrated after the defeat. Now, paragraph. Now, as to the technique which I spoke about that I utilized in connection with this 1954 campaign, it was used most effectively on television. It was the technique of the empty chair. In other words, I challenged Franklin D. Roosevelt constantly to debate, and that I would pay for the time on television. And when he failed or refused to accept my challenge, I had on every television show, and I had a good many, an empty chair to which I addressed my questions in respect of his failure to do his job in the House of Representatives and other charges which I made against him. And this turned out to be an extremely effective technique, the climax of which was a staged court proceeding which I had on television the Sunday before election, the last day on which one could really campaign, in which I had a court scene of a jury box, a witness chair, myself as the prosecuting attorney, and a good friend of mine, then a lawyer, whom I subsequently had the privilege of recommending for federal judge, Fred Van Pelt Bryan, as a presiding judge in judge's robes. And I conducted the thing as a trial in which Franklin D. Roosevelt Jr. was on trial. I asked him questions. I made statements to the jury, which was not in the box, obviously, but the jury box was there. I appealed to the judge. The judge made rulings, and I subsequently summed up to the jury, denouncing my opponent as the empty chair, both in the Congress and in respect of responding to legitimate demands to explain himself in a campaign. I think that technique, plus the break which I got, which I've described above, were the reasons for my victory in that campaign, which was a real watershed victory for me.